Morning, church. Man, it's such a blessing to be here this morning. As always, it's good to be gathered with the people of God. But I so appreciate this family and you all and for our time of worship that we have together every week. My wife wanted to make a request. This week, the Westwood School is doing their Thanksgiving meal. And they're trying to get volunteers, and she just needs a couple of volunteers to work a drink station, to work dispensing drinks to the kids. If you would be willing to do that, to just serve drinks to these kids for the school's Thanksgiving meal, you can just see her. I love Thanksgiving meals. For the food, obviously, but more than that, what has come to be for our family, I mean, we just never know who we're going to have Thanksgiving with. Every year. Sometimes it's family, sometimes it's friends, sometimes it's a mixture of both. But I love gathering around the table together. I think there's something really special about that. As we're going through the Gospel of Mark, we have come to the institution of the Lord's Supper in Mark 14, beginning at verse 12, really down through verse 31. We're going to be looking in particular at verses 12 through 25 this morning. One of the most famous images when we think about the Lord's Supper has to be this particular picture. It's one of Leonardo da Vinci's, not Leonardo DiCaprio, like I wanted to say, Leonardo da Vinci's most famous paintings. I mean, when you think of Leonardo da Vinci, you probably include this right up there. Or when you think of the Last Supper, you know, this is what you likely think of. This was completed, by the way, in 1498. It took him about 3 years to finish. It's an enormous piece. I think it's 150 centimeters by 300 centimeters. It's on the wall of a chapel. And what you may not know is that the original painting is so degraded and has been retouched so much over the years that very little is left that was actually put there by Da Vinci. Because he painted it on the wall of this chapel, and they were in a hurry to complete this chapel, and so they'd packed the walls with rubble, and there was still moisture in there, so the moisture started seeping through, and so it began to degrade almost immediately. The faces blurred, the lines disappeared, the colors changed, and then it began to flake off. They tried all sorts of remedies and had it retouched just, you know, like 50 years, within the first 50 years, had to be retouched, and then they tried for a while to cover it with a curtain so that the moisture wouldn't get to it. But what they found was that the curtain trapped the moisture in there. And every time they opened the curtain to look at it, more paint flaked off. They put a door under it underneath to go into another room at some point. So you'll see in some of the famous paintings, it looks like an arch of a doorway right beneath the table there as well. And so it has been changed so much. This is not actually Leonardo da Vinci's painting. This one was done about 1520 by one of his apprentices. There were three works done by different apprentices of his, basically trying to preserve what he had done. And because this one is not done on the wall of a brick and stucco building, this one was done on canvas with oil. And so it's been really, really well preserved, and curators can move that into a temperature and moisture-controlled environment, and they've been really able to care for and protect it. And so what we see here is that, as a result, this one done by the apprentices is actually more accurate than the one that was done by Da Vinci. Even though Da Vinci originally painted it, you know, the one that's done by the apprentices is closer to Da Vinci's work than Da Vinci's work. Really strange how that works. One of the regular practices of this church is to partake of the Lord's Supper, the table of the Lord, we call it sometimes. Every Sunday we gather and we have some men come up to the front and they will take these emblems, the bread and the cup, and we'll pass those around to commemorate the life, death, and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. The question I want us to consider this morning is the relationship of what we do here, we the apprentices, what relationship is what we do here with the Passover meal that Jesus led in that upper room? Maybe a better way of stating that is whether or not what we do here now, 2,000 years later, does it really matter? Does it really make any difference? What are we accomplishing? What are we doing when we gather here? What does it have to do with that meal that Jesus did all those years ago? Now, in Mark's gospel, we find out that it's the time for the Passover meal. And so Jesus and his disciples, who've been staying in Bethany, Jesus sends two disciples into the city, into Jerusalem. And he says, there you're going to meet a man who's carrying a jar of water, and you're going to follow him. Now, this was going to be really unusual, pretty easy to spot, because first and foremost, men don't carry water. Women do. And when men do carry water, it's not in a jar. They would carry it in some sort of leather skin. The jar was a woman's implement to carry water. But there's going to be a man with a jar of water. And so they said, Jesus said, just follow him. You go to the house. You'll meet the master of the house, and he's going to show you the place that's been prepared. So obviously something has gone on before, whether this is just Jesus and using his prophetic ability, but more likely it seems that Jesus has prearranged this, the fact that the room has already been set aside, because the room would have to be set up specifically for a meal like this. You'd have to bring in certain furniture, the low table and the cushions, because you couldn't celebrate the Passover meal in a fast food type of way. It was a specific way to enjoy the Passover meal, and the meal had to be eaten in Jerusalem. If you were celebrating the Passover meal, it had to be eaten in Jerusalem. That was the tradition. Well, Jerusalem is only limited in size, and they've got all these extra people there, so space was really at a premium. This is one of those you really had to prearrange a space. So the disciples go into Jerusalem. Sure enough, it goes just as Jesus said it was. And they find the man with the water. They find the master of the house. They find the room that has been prepared just as Jesus told them. Now, the usual Passover meal was to be led by the father of the household. That's the way Passover worked. And so this father, this man of the house, would be the one to sort of direct the comments throughout the meal, to lead the discussion throughout the meal. But in this case, we can clearly see that it's Jesus who is the head of the table, that it's Jesus who leads the discussion. So in a lot of ways, even though this isn't Jesus' house, that Jesus is serving as the host of this Passover table. In a very real sense, this is the table of the Lord. Right, he is the one who's at the head of the table. And these disciples, the 12, have been invited to be a part of Jesus' family in eating this Passover with him. Because you eat Passover with your family. Now, traditionally, at the Passover, there would be different courses. You've got a course of almost like appetizers and vegetables, and then there would be a course of with the bread, and a course with the roasted lamb with the bitter herbs that you were supposed to eat. And along with those courses, you've got four cups of wine that everyone had. And then we think by the first century that everyone pretty well had their own cup, that we're going to see Jesus does something different. But traditionally, by this point, everybody had their own cup. So you would have your own four cups of wine, or more likely you would have a cup refilled three times during the meal. But all those things had to be prepared. The room was ready, but you still needed the lamb, you still needed the bread, you still needed all the cups and everything. So likely this is what the two disciples were sent ahead to prepare for. You had to get the lamb and take it down to the temple for it to be sacrificed by the priest, bring it back, roast it with the bitter herbs. All that had to be done, so that's what they're likely doing. And the Passover was a time of remembrance. It was a time to think back and recall how God had rescued his people from Egyptian slavery, right? Remember, Joseph had gone down to Egypt, and all of his family eventually followed there as he saved them from starvation, and eventually their population grew, and the Egyptians enslaved them, made them slaves, and how God came in with the 10 plagues. You remember the 10 plagues? And with the final one being that the angel of the Lord was going to pass over the households, and only those with the blood of the sacrificed lamb on their doorpost would be saved. Every other household would have their firstborn killed. So the Passover was a time to remember back to that, how the angel of the Lord would pass over their houses and preserve them. And it was a time also to remember how God took this now ragtag band of slaves and made out of them a people. So as the courses were eaten, as you go through the courses and you drink the cups, the father of the house, the head of the table, would recount God's mighty acts of deliverance and God's faithfulness to his people. So Jesus and his disciples, they're finally all ready. And they're assembled in this upper room for this really special, powerful meal. And this is how the discussion begins. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. While they were reclining at the table eating, he said, "Truly, I tell you." And by the way, whenever Jesus says truly, that's a prophetic moment. He's like, this is assuring you this is going to happen. Anytime you see this in Mark, it's Jesus being a prophet. And he says, "Truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me. One who is eating with me." They were saddened. And one by one, they said to him, "Surely you don't mean me. Surely you don't mean me." Jesus says, "It is one of the 12. One who dips bread into the bowl with me." Now, contrary to popular belief, this was not like a moment where Judas and Jesus magically had their bread in the same bowl at the same time, though that could have happened. What Jesus is referring to is just saying someone who sits here at my table, who also dips their bread in the same bowl I drip my bread in, like all of you are going to do at some point tonight. It's one of my closest confidants. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. Now, Jesus has been saying all along, as we've gone through Mark's gospel, we've seen this, that he was going to be betrayed, that someone was going to turn him over to the religious leaders, and he's even talked about being suffering and dying, and he's talked about all of that, but never has he revealed the identity of his betrayer. And so now, for the first time, the disciples know this is not just someone out there who doesn't like Jesus who's going to betray him. It is one of us. It is one of us who is going to betray Jesus. And so you get shock and outrage. How could this be? You know, one of us here at this table, how could it be one of us? And you think you know people. You've been walking around with them for 3 years, and you think you know Jesus. And who would do this to Jesus? Because in Eastern culture, there's even more shock. Because at the table, that's where associates and companions, that's where they become family. The people you eat with, that's your family. To put a back in the knife of your host was one of the most repulsive things you could do in that culture. Someone has welcomed you to their table, invited you to be a part of their family. To betray him, to turn your back on him, was one of the worst things you could do. And so this painting, The Last Supper, sort of portrays the reaction. You may see how people are talking right here. This is supposed to capture all of the shock and all the indignity, all their different reactions, anger, frustration. I mean, there's just all of these things sort of captured in here. Later, we'll learn specifically that Peter would deny Jesus 3 times. Jesus said, "You'll deny me 3 times before the cock crows twice." And then he says, then all the disciples, all of you are going to abandon Jesus at his greatest hour of need. Like at the time when he needed their support the most, they were all going to turn and run. Every one of them. All of them. And we have this tendency to think about Jesus as maybe cold and emotionless or detached. Maybe that's a better way of thinking of it. Like Jesus is detached from the people around him. He just sort of floats along and nothing really affects him. Nobody could hurt him. Nothing could change his mood. And with a tendency to think of him almost like a holy statue. But clearly in Mark's text, this betrayal and abandonment by his closest friends, that hurt Jesus. I mean, it's clear. In Gethsemane, when he goes into Gethsemane after this, he asks for them to stay close. He asks them to pray and keep watch with him. He wants their companionship. He wants their support. And we see that when we fall asleep, Jesus chastises them. And then he practically begs them, please stay with me. Please. I need this. Seems to be hidden in his words there. I remember when I first became a Christian, and maybe you can remember back to that time too. I remember when I came up out of that water and I was all clean and I was all new, and I remember eating Sunday lunch with my family, and I remember being certain that I was always going to do the right thing from now on. You remember that? That I was never going to turn my back on Jesus. That I would never abandon him. That I would never betray him. And I also vividly remember that moment of guilt and shame when I realized I had done precisely that, that I had betrayed my first love. I mean, how could I ever show my face to him again, knowing that he knows exactly what I have done, that he watched over me and saw what I did when I turned my back on him? How could he be willing to ever associate with me again? Why would he even want that? And yet Jesus knows. And this is what he says. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, take, this is my body. And then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many, he said to them. Truly I tell you, here's the word truly, I'm seeing into the future again. Truly I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. Isn't it something that Jesus, knowing full well that all of these friends and now family members would abandon him or betray him, that he still chose to share this meal with them, that his table was still open to them? One of the most shocking stories we see woven into the table is this story of abandonment and rejection and redemption, that is threaded in to the table. And far from being surprised, it wasn't like Jesus was shocked by this. Jesus knows exactly what kind of people these are seated at his table, that he sees their flaws, he knows their weaknesses, he understands that none of them are going to get it back, get it right. And yet, he still chooses not just to eat dinner with them, which was a big deal, not just to eat Passover with them, which was a bigger deal, but to offer them his body and pour out his blood on his behalf. At the Passover meal with his disciples who are going to abandon and betray him, directly before his death and his resurrection, Jesus changes the meaning of that supper from a reminder about escape from slavery in Egypt to a reminder of his life, of his sacrifice that he is making to bring freedom from the slavery to sin. And he's offering this to them through him. Now, Jesus' blood, we know, means his sacrificial death, that he's going to die. But his body means Jesus is offering himself, like he is giving himself. It's a promise to stay with them. This is a bread. The bread is a promise of abiding presence. That's what you get in the bread. That I'm going to stay with you. I know you're going to abandon me. I'm going to stay with you. I know you're going to betray me. I'm going to stay with you. And so this morning, many of you think that because you've gone too far, you've said too much, you've loved too little, because you've done and said and thought all wrong things for so long, because of what you've done, that you are unworthy, and you see yourself as unworthy to sit at this table, at the table of the Lord. But the good news of Jesus Christ, the message at the heart of the Gospel of Mark, is that Jesus sees exactly how broken and how flawed and how messed up you are, and he still says, come to the table. He sees, and for those of you who are not Christians yet, you may be thinking, I don't want to be a Christian yet because I know I don't want to do anything wrong, right? I don't want to betray Jesus. I don't want to make a commitment that I know I can't keep. Jesus knows that, and he still says, come. I know you're going to be faithless. Come. I know you're going to do things that you think are irreparable, that you can't fix. And that might be true in the world, but it's not true in this kingdom. Come. I know you're going to do things that shame you and haunt you. Come. I know you. Now come. And so this morning, we invite you, no matter where you are in your relationship with Christ, to come to the table, to eat the bread of the presence of Jesus, to share in the cup that is the new covenant we have in Jesus Christ. And in taking the bread and in drinking the cup, our bodies are transformed to be a little more Jesus. Because you are what you eat, right? You're going to take this bread and you're going to take this cup, and your body is going to make you out of it. Isn't that amazing? That you are becoming a little more Jesus today.